All right, so welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. Good to have you all here. We've turned this into a hub for literary, the whole literary community, writers, poets, authors, the whole gamut. We have a podcast now, elainesliterarysalon.com. We're number one on Spotify, and we're number three on Apple for literary stuff. It's really nice to have like a safe space here where authors can come in and just and get some camaraderie and get away from that being alone part of the writing process.
Yes.
So I'm excited about this. I'm happy for you and looking forward to this.
Thank you.
Rebecca Morrison was born in Iran and immigrated to the United States in her teens. In 2020, after practicing law for over two decades, she decided to pursue her dreams of becoming a writer. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC News, Newsweek, The Independent, and HuffPost, among others. Her debut novel, The Blue Dress, based on her childhood as an Iranian immigrant trying to fit into her family's expectations of beauty in her American homeland, launched in March. Rebecca has also hosted a podcast called The Second Half about the struggle, heartbreak, healing, and joy people experience in the second half of life. She's represented by Aaron Namada at Folio Literary Management for adult books and John Cusick at Folio Junior for children's books. And I apologize in advance for probably screwing up the pronunciation on both those names. So please welcome Rebecca Morrison.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, congratulations on the book. This is a big deal. I always get really excited when I talk to debut authors because people don't realize how hard it is. It's over 80% of people say they have a book in them or plan to write a book, and like 3% start and only 1% ever finish. And then of that 1%, the chance of getting published is so low, and the chance of getting traditionally published is lower, and the chance of getting traditionally published by a big five imprint is unbelievably low. Like if you tell people the odds, they just probably won't even pick up a pen to begin with. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Blue Dress?
The Blue Dress is based on my childhood. My mother did sew me a blue dress when I was a teen. It is based on my experience as an Iranian immigrant coming to the U.S. and having both the struggle of identity with being an immigrant and also struggling with body image. My mother wanted me to have a smaller body. She thought that was that would, you know, give me happiness and power and success. And because she thought it was so important, she put a lot of pressure on me that resulted in disordered eating and other really hard struggles between me and my mother. So the mother-daughter story is a big part of this book. It's about a 13-year-old girl named Yasmin who comes to America only a couple years ago, and her best friend, Carmen, who is of Mexican descent, are trying to figure out their identities and go through the school experience. And at the same time, she, Yasmin, has this conflict with her mother that she has to figure out and with her own body.
Such important themes. And I want to get kind of go deeply into them a little bit.
Absolutely.
But first, I just want to ask you, like, so this comes from your childhood. So was this something that you wanted to write about always, or was it something you just always thought about? Or where was the transition from like childhood trauma to like, let me put this in a book? Like,
that's
when did that
happen? Question. Yeah. You know, I love what you said earlier. For decades, I wanted to write this story. Since I was a teenager, really around 13, I have been fighting. I've been fighting not just my mother, but her entire ideas about what it means to be a woman. And society, both in our American culture and in cultures around the world, this idea that a woman's worth, her value, what she represents to the world is so primarily tied to her beauty and her body is something I fought against because ever since I was really an 8-year-old girl in Iran and asking the questions of why can a boy do this and not a girl? Why are boys praised for doing something and not girls? I've wanted to say we are worth more than that. Our primary worth is our intelligence, our ability to, you know, do any challenge, our thoughts, our ideas, all of our productivity, meaningful, purposeful life. So I've spent a lifetime thinking about this. And like you said, for decades, I was one of those people. I want to write this story. And I really didn't think it was possible. I have to tell you the truth. To me, being a writer, a traditional writer, having a book in the bookstore, in the library, was as far off as me saying at 49, I want to be an astronaut. It just felt really impossible. But the pandemic hit and I was in my home, and somehow my legal job was cut off. I was let go of my contracting job because the company had laid off people and all their contractors. And I sat there and I thought, if not now, when? When am I going to go after this dream? So I started taking writing classes. This was 5-6 years ago. And I started writing this story. I realized that little by little, I started writing essays in national publications. And even that was a dream. And I did it the old, like the old-fashioned stalker-like persistence of emailing editors that didn't know me, Googling, emails and sending to people everywhere. And a couple of them hit and a couple of them said yes. And then I started writing bits of this story for national pubs. And then I started writing this as a memoir first. I wanted this story for adults. And I met a publisher in New York just walking to an event. And she asked me what I was writing. And I told her it was about a mother-daughter and about an immigrant. And she said, write this for teens and preteens, because especially the disordered eating, the body image issues start so early in our schools and in kids' lives. She said, there's a space for this, so write it. And I just took her advice. The minute she said that to me, something went, just clicked. And I was so determined that I spent the next year writing this book and still publishing and essays. And agents contacted me. They'd read my pieces and said, what are you working on? We want to represent you. And I did. And I finished the book and they sent it out and publisher said yes.
I love the tenacity that you showed to make that happen, because the only thing that's common for all published authors is they don't give up, right? Like, and I love that tenacity.
Yeah.
By the way, it's the second time I've heard in the last couple of weeks where somebody was told, make your book like YA or go children, and it sold, and it sold to Big Five. Yeah, you said something that I'm curious about. Couldn't agree with you more about the worth of a human being and what they have. And people tend to, like, within familiar structures, within friends, family, that's how we judge each other, right? Judge by behavior and who the person is. But when you don't know somebody, so society writ large, right? It tends to be very superficial. And for women, it's maybe the traditional beauty. And for men, it's like how tall they are. You know, there's studies on leadership, right?
Yeah.
With men, and the taller they are, people just assume a level of authority. So.
Right.
I guess my question is, because you've been thinking about this for a long time.
Yes.
How, when you're addressing, first off, can you address these societal issues? And then if so, is it through what you're doing, through the articles, through trying to make people aware of it? Because there's really an evolutionary basis to that, right? Like in the animal kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. Like women do things to attract the male, the species, right? Mm-hmm. And so we sort of adopted that.
Yeah.
And you like to think we're above it. But if you don't know people, so.
I like that. You know what? I'm going to tell you something. I challenge the idea that being thin or being a certain look is what attracts men. I disagree. I think it is what's your confidence. I think it's the way you move your body. It's the way you talk to a man or a person that you're trying to attract. It's your joy, your intelligence, your humor. All of that is in a package. And I am absolutely not against being sexy and beautiful and for men to be, handsome or whatever the attraction is to other people. What I am against is telling a society that it's only one way a woman can be attractive. And I disagree. And, I've lived my life confident in who I am and my own body and movement and life. And that's the message I want to tell girls and women, is that you can be beautiful and competent and successful in the way you are without having to fit into a certain current society mold, right? Throughout history.
I love how you say that because, right? Like, in our 250 years of history in this country, just that short amount of time, you've seen the desired body image change up and down and back and forth, right? So it's different in different cultures.
Right.
It's different everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we think about it, if you meet somebody who is confident in who they are, the way they walk, the way they talk to you, if they know themselves and they truly believe in who they are and they believe in their own kind of like internal strength and power, they're very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And our visual, like first, you know, kind of what our bodies look like right off the bat, that fades and that personality kind of changes the way you see somebody. And I've written about this recently for a publication called Ulster, and it just went so wide because so many people related to this idea of how we can make others see us by the way we kind of believe we see ourselves.
Yeah, no, confidence and intelligence, right, is a huge attractor of people. And it's funny, I can think of so many individual cases where somebody was attracted to someone purely physically, but very young, and they get together, and then they realize they're completely opposite personality types, right?
Yeah.
They couldn't work in any way. So back to your book a little
bit.
So, like, how long did it take to write?
Yeah. So this was it's shorter than I've heard a lot of other writers, only because this is a story I knew. So, like, I wanted to get this down on paper. And I had about 50 pages when I started, and I'd written, like, little parts of it. Many parts of this book are based on real experiences and real memories. So I almost was pushed into doing this fast. And I'll tell you why. Because this publisher told me, I didn't tell you this. So I met this publisher. She said, turn it into a book. I thought, well, I looked her up. She's a major publisher. And she got on a Zoom with me because she was interested in my story. And that's the advice she told me. And I thought, oh, she's going to buy this book. I was so excited, and I sent her a synopsis and 20 pages, and she read it, and she said, don't be disappointed. I'm not going to take this right now. First of all, you need an agent, but also you need the time to actually know how to write a book. You need to work on it. But she said the one thing that like really lit a fire under me, which was, your story's good.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if my story is good, the synopsis, which was a page long, I thought, I have the roadmap, now I just need to put it on paper. So I just really hustled for a year. And it's the hardest I've worked on anything in my life, even though I've been a lawyer for almost 30 years. So the first draft, the first real solid draft was a year. I had an agent by then who had contacted me and signed me up. I'd done a couple of drafts. And then once I sold it, I still worked on it with the editor of the, you know, with the publisher for another year and a half. So the whole thing was about 2 years of writing, 2-3 years.
So was it surprising how hard like the actual craft of writing was? So by the way, your craft is wonderful.
Thank you.
Are wonderful. You have phrases in there like right at the beginning, like, you know, the blue dress was like a cloudless sky. You know, I love that. Like that kind of imagery that you're bringing into it. So when you like it's kind of a non-traditional way that you kind of backed into this. So it was because of putting out these non-fiction articles about this. That's what attracted it.
Yes. Because
you see that in non-fiction works. You don't see it as much, sometimes a memoir, but you don't see it as much in a work of fiction.
Right.
So how much interest did you have? It's out there. You mentioned agents reaching out to you. I mean, this is so rare, right?
Yeah.
The average agent gets 4,000 queries. Like, they take one out of every 4,000 queries.
Right.
They come in, many of them are getting 100 a day.
Yeah.
So for an agent to reach out, it's almost always a scam, right?
Yeah.
So,
it's true.
Like, how many agents? I mean, I know writers are interested in this, and we have a lot of writers in our audience. So how many agents reach out to you?
This is really interesting, and I tell writers that ask me about this, one of the best ways to get interest from an agent is to write a piece that is broadly read or that hits a tone that is kind of sparks something. So it's unusual, but I've written about 4 viral essays. And viral means different things. But one of them, for example, the editor told me 3 million people at least had read.
Wow, that's huge.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That was my very first piece that I did for a national publication in HuffPost.
That's a high bar for you.
It's a high bar. The second piece got nothing. So I thought, wait a minute, isn't every piece going to have 3 million readers? No. But it was about, it's a combination, it's a couple things. It wasn't because I was a great writer, honestly. I was an average writer still trying to work on my craft. It's about the subject. It was about, my very first piece was about being an immigrant, what it means to be American. That's something a lot of people relate to and care about. And it was about a story that had kind of not just a beginning, middle, and end, but that the end landed in a way that gave you chills or that made you really think, like, I need to forward this to someone because I can relate to it. So it was just, it was about my name. My name is Rebecca Morrison, but I'm from Iran. And I explain kind of how I got there and how somebody said something hurtful to me about my name because they were looking for a white Morrison, a white American, Scottish-looking Morrison. They saw me and they dismissed me as taking my husband's Morrison, and because I was clearly not the Morrison they were looking for. And I wrote about how at first I felt very humiliated and I agreed with them. Like, I'm taking my husband's Americanness. This was 10, 15.
I don't even know what that means.
I know.
Taking someone's Americanness. What a crazy concept, right?
Because as immigrants, we have immigrant names. And so people can kind of identify us by that. But this man at a conference was looking for Rebecca Morrison. His last name was Morrison. He was looking for, I want to meet this other, Irish, Scottish, American, white person, I guess. Because when he saw me, he walked up to me and he said, you're not a Morrison. You just married a Morrison. And in that moment, and he just walked away. And it crushed me in that moment because I had just gotten married and I had just taken my husband's name.
Oh, good timing.
I know.
Yeah.
So I thought, is he right? Am I pretending?
Could you hear him through his white hood when he was standing? What a crappy thing to say. We might have an IQ problem at some of these conferences.
But you know, I took that once, that really 2-3 minutes, and I made this into a story. And by the end of the story, by the time, because I describe it first, I do. You're like, you wonder, like, should I have kept my original name? And I took my husband's name really because I love him and I was starting a family. I thought that's kind of what you do, you know? And I talk about how I had kids and my kids now are Morrisons. And this is many years later, and how I can be Iranian and I can have my traditions and I can have that name. And by the end of that piece, I kind of landed it, talking about craft, landed it with a sentence that hits about how my husband came here, his family hundreds of years ago, and I came here a couple of, you know, decades ago. We're both American in the same way. Mm-hmm. And even if that man doesn't believe it, his children or his grandchildren or great-grandchildren will believe that we are all American in the same way. Like, something that hits. So writing these essays about body image and identity, things that a lot of people relate to, I went vulnerable, I went extreme authentic, and I was able to write a story in 1,200 words, which is the average for these publications, 1,000 to 1,200. And in these couple of different essays, the other one that went viral was about a mother and daughter struggling with body image. And I tell you, a lot of people can identify with that, even if they disagree with it. Either agree or disagree, they'll read it. Because women's bodies, people have a lot of opinions about them. So when agents see a story that hits, that is resonates with a big population, and that, you know, maybe is in the zeitgeist of our country, immigrant issues, body image issues, I think that's why agents contacted me.
I love that you talk about that, like what it means to be American, because it really is, it's like values, right? It's an ideal. It's something that you're looking for, like elements of American exceptionalism or things that people come to share together as opposed to how long you've been in the country.
Right.
So when you put these things out, you mentioned the authenticity of and how, because that's what creates, it's the emotion that creates the universality of it, right? So when you're writing things that are this raw and this personal, how hard is it, like the first article that you wrote, that you're really going into personal stuff, when you saw that, like, in print, did you have, like, a moment of stark terror, like, to reveal, like, your inner self?
Yes, I'll tell you something. I love being American, and I'm one of those immigrants that just came here and was just, my mother says this, and it's 100% true. She says, you were American before you knew what America was. I was born in Iran. I was stomping around in Tehran as a six-year-old saying, I want to be able to do this or that. You know, I want equality. I want freedom. I came here. I loved it. I love America from just every, like, fiber of my being. Having said that, I was terrified at different times in my life, like 9/11, after 9/11, of somebody saying to me, I'm gonna get emotional.
I make everybody cry, so don't worry about it.
I was always scared that somebody would say to me, go back to your country, that you are not American. And I did everything in my power growing up to be as American as possible. And some immigrants do this because we yearn belonging. We yearn to be part of this fabric of this country so much that we do that. And so nobody said that to me because I don't have an accent, and I'm very, very kind of, I worked hard at kind of fitting in. Okay. Then I decide to write honestly about that struggle of identity. And the first piece I write is the one I described to you. And in the comments, what I feared most in my life happened, right? So 90% great response, 10% or 5% or 3% of people saying, you don't like it here, why don't you go back to your own country?
But of course, right? If you're looking at a huge body of people, there's always going to be people at the tails of that curve that are horrible in whatever way.
But you know what? It kind of freed me. The first time you want to throw up because you're so crushed by it. The second time it really hurts. The third time you're like, I heard it before. Mm-hmm. The fourth time, you're like, be more creative with your response, you know? And it almost gave me, like, power. Like, let's write about this again. Let's write about this again. Because when you get that, you know, so many people, that piece got really a lot. Hundreds of people emailed me saying that America is so filled with people that get and love immigrants. I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Because either they are an immigrant, or they know an immigrant, or they love an immigrant, or
they're from immigrants.
Right. It's just all of us. Yeah. And so that showed me the power of it. Mm-hmm. And it really helped me be a more courageous writer.
So that, like deadening yourself to some of this criticism is a necessary skill as an author, right? What I do, and this is a fun trick, go and pick the best books you've ever read and go on Amazon and look at the 1-star reviews and just make yourself feel better. Because, like, the greatest works of fiction that were ever done, there's people on there who hated them, right? And so you just can't please everybody, you know? And at some point, if you get enough of it, right, you just stop caring.
Right,
like, you know, if everybody says something, maybe you pay attention to it. But if, you know, that's the majority.
Yeah.
So how many agents, and then how did you decide on your agent?
So very early on, an agent contacted me, and it's because I had written a tiny love story in the New York Times. I think that was the second thing I published, and it was 100 words, exactly the core of this book. I think the first sentence was, my mother got a daughter that she never wanted, or something like that. And so it was just really sharp. And
it's a great opening.
Yeah, it was sad, but it told the entire story in 100 words, and about the journey of starting that way and then coming to understand and love each other as imperfect women. That was what it was called, Imperfect Women. And an agent contacted me. Agents read, those big publications, and especially Modern Love in the New York Times, and then the Tiny Love Stories. They're looking for, you know, these stories that kind of hit on a nerve. And she said, when you finish your memoir, contact me. That was too early. And I hadn't really done anything. I'd written like three little pieces. So I kept going. And then about a year and a half into it, I wrote a story for today.com, for the Today Show. And it was a longer version of that 100 words. It was about my mother and I, a very specific time where an incident where I was a teenager, and kind of like the core of this book is I was hiding food and she caught me. And she was saying, you know, the thing a lot of mothers say to daughters and parents say to children, I'm doing this because I love you. I want the best for you.
That's also abuser language, right? I'm doing this because I love you. Look what you made me do.
That's right. And then I talk about kind of how, you know, I fought that. And then I taught my mother, and she talks about this. I taught my mother like to look at things differently and how our worth is more than that. And you can succeed and be loved and be beautiful and be, have a gorgeous, life. Successful, meaningful life the way, you know, the way you are. And that went viral. And that's when a second agent contacted me and we got on Zoom. I was ready by then to like, this is the interesting part. She thought I was writing a memoir, which is makes sense from all the essays sure. I'd written. And I said to her, I have just decided to write a YA. And she didn't do YA. She did adult books, memoirs, novels. And she said, well, you know, maybe I can. And I had heard advice from another author that I had seen recently, Dave Eggers, who is a beautiful writer. And he said to me, if you end up looking for agents, make sure that the agent is an expert in that genre. Yeah. So I said to the agent, I'm looking for a kid lit agent. And she's at a huge fantastic agency Folio, and I really liked her for adult stuff. And she's like, oh, let me introduce you to a kid lit agent. And she was honest about it. I can't guarantee anything. Like you said, these agents get a lot of interest. And the agent, you know, kind of interviewed me, got my pages, got the story I had written. And I told him that, you know, the story was, a publisher was interested in the story. And he read everything and he said, I want to take you on. So it was great.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, you want the someone who's doing like children's literature just because they know the tropes, they know the reader expectations,
right.
But also they have the contacts,
exactly.
Right? And so already having a publisher interested, by the way, is a very good way to get an agent. So you didn't go wider at that point and try to shop for other agents.
I didn't. And it's funny you ask because this is such a very specific inside industry question. There were people that told me it's too soon. You know, wait, you have all these viral essays. Figure, you know, maybe you should look and query other agents just to see, because everybody wants to get the best agent or the, you know. And I thought, I have two fantastic agents that are interested in me. And I really liked both of them. And I didn't query anyone.
So when they were interviewing you, the children's literature, right? You're also interviewing them, right? So what was it? You say you liked them. Like, what was it about them? Like, was it that they got what you were, your messaging or that they liked your writing, or what was that connection?
That's a great question. I asked a lot of authors, what is important about having an agent? What do you look for? Honestly, people now, I have so many writer friends, and there is a very big difference between having the top agents in the country and having, you know, all the way to like maybe a smaller agency. And there's this thing about how you could have a superstar agent, like literally the top. They're not going to be able to, for the most part in general, talk to you whenever you want.
Right.
And some writer, like a very successful writer I talked to, he said, I talk to my agent twice a year.
Yeah.
When I finish my book, and telling him, like, I'm on my way, you know? And that's not what I wanted. I want an agent that can respond to me, that can maybe brainstorm with me, that can make me feel better. Mm-hmm. I am a sensitive person. I am a person that likes to communicate and open mind. So I was looking for agents that, A, believed in my story, but also believed in me as a person and how I wanted to grow as a writer. And it was really important. Like, if I email you, I need to know that you're going to email me back. And
that's so smart.
You know, in a couple, like at least. And so both of them were very, very open about that. And I actually called their, I did some research myself. I called other clients of theirs, interviewed them to see what relationship they had with the agent I was looking at, and everybody, you know, it worked out.
I mean, that like figuring out that your communication styles were you know,
really
working
important.
Together. Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems for most, right. Most of the authors I know who've left their agents is because of that.
Right.
So now that you have the agent, did they go to the original publisher first, or did they go out to different publishers? How did that work? And I'm asking because so many people want to know how this actually
absolutely.
Happens.
Absolutely. No, this was a big question. By the time I finished it, you know, my agent really loved the book. And there was some thought about doing some books go on auction for the Big Five so that the Big Five, if it's really good, can like, you know, fight for it. And then you get a bigger advance.
Which is a double-edged sword.
It definitely is. And I was adamant and my agent agreed that this person, this woman, I'm going to say her name, Joy Peskin, who believed in me, who spent time on Zooms telling me that my story was good, who read my synopsis when she is a very busy person in a big public, in a, it's the imprint is FSG at Macmillan. I said, let's give her an opportunity first. So it was an exclusive submission to her. And we gave her a couple weeks to decide before we would go to any other publisher.
I love that. I mean, because of the enthusiasm of an acquiring editor means so much into the success within the imprint,
but also
just generally, right? So all those decisions you made were exactly right. So how did you do that? You said you talked to some other successful authors. Is that where it came from? You did some research. Did you apply like your same legal process that you would do in your job to this to try to figure it out? Because there were no missteps there.
Oh my gosh, thank you. You know, I think this is an element of being a writer later in my life. So I'm in my 50s and I kind of went with my gut on these things. I did ask for advice. I think that's, you know, that was great. I was able to do that. But every decision I made, it felt like the right decision. But I always do my research and I try to figure out I try to figure out what everybody else has done in the industry. But you know, meeting Joy, a lot of the success I've had in the last 5 years, besides kind of like being driven and working hard, which I think are really important, is chance and being a person. Like, I love a connection that I make with another person. And this woman, when I was walking with her, she was like, what do you write about? And I just was, I wasn't thinking that she's a publisher because I, you know, I never thought about a children's book at first. So I was so comfortable and I was like, you know, this is how I grew up and it's a complicated thing. And her and I kind of had a connection in that moment and I really liked her. And then when I met my agent, we talked about life. And if I don't have that connection, it just doesn't work. So everything kind of was fit into my personality, which is if I feel something, you know, like that spark between another human mm-hmm. being, it just feels right.
So once they acquired it, how long did you work with the imprint before the book came out?
Oof. So the book came out 2 years, I think, after they bought it, maybe 2.5 years.
Did that surprise you, by the way? Because a lot of people are shocked by that, but that's the norm.
I was devastated, I'll tell you right now. I can't even believe it's here. I was like, how is that possible? When they told me, or in that announcement, publisher's announcement.
Yeah, it's great.
It's so cool when they buy a book. And it said 2026. I genuinely thought it was a typo because I sold it in 2024.
Yeah.
And I thought, that makes no sense. Why would it take 2 years for a book to come out? But looking back, you know, it's not just, and people have asked me this a lot, and now I understand it. It's not that it takes 2 years. It's that that's your turn. Mm-hmm. The publisher, big publishers, have a very specific order and time for each book to come out for specific reasons. Mine was in March. Nobody explained this to me, but when it came out in March, I got it. It tied into a lot of things from my book. March is when Persian New Year is. which is the beginning of my book. March is Women's History Month, which this book is about, you know, a mother-daughter story. But also it was my turn, I guess, you know. But it took us a full year to work and edit the book. And things that I never would have thought in a million years.
Like what?
First of all, it's not just the editor that reads your book. There is a list of people at the publication that read your book. And they have, like, the researcher, I can't remember what they're called, but the researcher that reads it is looking for everything from a cookie recipe. If that makes sense, do you put the butter in first or do you put in the, you know, sugar in first? Like, we had discussions because I talk about making cookies and they're like, well, is that how it would go into the bowl? You know, they're so.
Don't you love that, though? Doesn't
so
it give you like
specific.
A it's a sense of security, right?
Yeah,
that they're actually like have your back.
They care about every detail. I talk about Yasmin's brother, Ali's work. Both my boys loved video games. So I have a video game in here. Mario Kart, I believe. The 10-year-old brother is playing. And we had a lot of discussions. Did Mario Kart come out, you know, there? What kind of game are you talking about? And I had Ali playing that with his sister, with Yasmin. They were like, that's a one-person game. It's not a two-person game. So those things surprised me. The other thing, which I think is good, the two things that were difficult for me is when the editor was like, you need to go back and do a thorough editing of this. And I thought, wait, you said you love this book. You bought it. And I thought you thought it was perfect. But I had to go back and do thorough editing. And one of the things I tell writers that ask me is that you'd be surprised at is cliches. And I'm not talking about like cliches that are obvious cliches. Right. I'm talking about any description in this book that is commonly used needs to change. Yeah. Every description has to be as original as possible. Yeah. And that was very difficult for me. I have a scene where I'm trying on pants and I think I said my legs were like sausages in the, you know, squeezed in sausages in a thing. And it was, I think, she was like, that's too on the point, on the nose. Mm-hmm. Like, and it took me a long time to go through line by line of this entire book and make sure everything, every sentence was clean. Every sentence was as originally thought as mm-hmm. possible.
If it's too common or, you know, too familiar to the reader, they get bored over time. Like
Apparently,
subconsciously, they don't understand why, but they've heard it before.
Right.
And so that's like, you know, your blue dress, like with the cloudless sky, that's unique. Yeah, you know what I mean? And that sticks with people, stuck with me, right?
Yeah.
So it sticks with people. Okay, so the book finally comes out.
Yeah.
Tell me when you get your box of author copies. I always love this moment. So tell me about that.
You know, I'll tell you this. For me, it was a little bit different. I'm type A lawyer type. And so I was just like, I got to do promos. 6 months out, I'm like, okay, let's get going on this. So I started emailing different people, libraries and TV stations and everything. So a TV station, a friend of mine connected me to a TV station and they wanted to interview me, but it was really early in before the book was going to come out. So it was in February. And I didn't have a copy. And I'm like, how am I going to go on there and talk about a book without like some kind of like physical copy? So I asked my publisher, can you send me something? They're like, oof, it's tight and we don't have it, you know. So they sent me a mock-up.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
it was just the cover like it was going to be. And when I opened that FedEx or whatever on my front steps, I was going for a walk with a friend and I walked. We got to my house and I saw the FedEx on my front step and I sat down and she's a writer and she's great on social media. So she just pulled out her phone immediately and videotaped me. And I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, trust me, you're going to like this. And I just ripped that thing open and pulled out this book with the cover that I love so much. And it really, really, it just like was such a heart bursting moment. It was very sweet.
So like, what are the emotions? Because, you know, part of it must be a little trepidation, right? Too, because you have this very personal thing that's out there, but also you've worked for years on this. And in this case, this is a story that you wanted to tell since you were a little kid.
It's true. Yeah. It's amazing. But a lot of it is, especially when the book first comes out or right before it comes out, you just, as being a debut author, you don't know what it's going to be. You just don't even, you can't even understand how it's going to be. A lot of it were mysteries for me. And each step has been, and not to interview you, but that first book is different than any other book, right?
A little bit, you haven't been through the process. So everything's new the first time. Yeah. So it's different, but it's still exciting every time because you're holding a physical manifestation of ideas that were in your imagination, and that's a really weird thing.
It is a weird thing. And you wonder who's going to read it, who's going to connect to it. And the first time somebody you've never known or heard of emails or posts about it, and you think, oh my God, this stranger just found my book and read my story and they're connecting to it. It's amazing.
Isn't it weird when people are talking to you about your characters?
Oh my gosh, it is. I know.
So I think on Amazon it said like ages 10 to 14 or something, and you're talking about YA. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of crossing different junctures. Yeah. And I can see how this would be good for everybody, right? Yeah. So when you're writing this, did you have to hit like these certain tropes? Did you have to hit certain things to make it fit into one of those categories?
No.
Or is it basically just a kid's book?
Right. No, it's such a great question. I wrote this as a memoir at first, and I turned this into this novel. And this novel is for that age, but it's also for every age. And that's why I feel like it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. I did not try to fit it for kids. It's a story of a 13-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. That is, I stayed true to that. But everything else about it is, I think, just really how I feel as a woman remembering my 13-year-old self.
So they generally say it's like 2 years past. So as a 13-year-old, it would be targeting 15-year-olds because people like to read about kids that are older than them. But I could see this working for adults, right? Yeah, like
I've had a mother reading this and saying, what am I doing? Most of the responses so far, because not a lot of kids have read it because it just came out last month, most of the responses have been from grown women, from women, from mothers, from women that don't even have kids that have just know me through social media and have read it, librarians, teachers, and they've connected to it because it's not just the daughter's story, it's the mother's story too. Mm-hmm. The only thing I had to change or that I had to add that was more than me was I had to make sure that there was a school element. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way that it gets really more like for that age group, is that I had to make sure that there was, she had a storyline at school, because kids, that's a huge part of their life. That's the only part I think I really added to hit that age group.
So I mean, I find this really interesting because it's children's literature too. Mm-hmm. And so like how you're able to talk to kids about some of these issues. So maybe I'll approach it from two different ways. So from the child's point of view, like how is the mother's language and the criticism, like in what ways is that damaging to the child?
Right. You know, the words that we hear from the most important people in our lives, our parents, when we are that age, kind of become concrete in our minds. So I'm in my mid-50s, and I still fight those words, even though my mother for many years now has said, I love you the way you are, I think you're amazing. And I kind of almost taught her to, like, see me in a different way over the years.
How did you do that?
That's a good question. I fought her for decades. That's how I did it. I almost had to prove to her, like, look at what I can do with my life. Look at, you know, I know this might be, you know, it's not a test, but look at the amazing husband I have, the amazing, you know, life I've created, the success I've had, the happiness I can bring to my life and still look a way that maybe you didn't think originally was ideal. And she has told me, like, you changed the way I see women or the worth of women. And I don't blame her. When I had my kids, I understood that, like, as a mother, you see certain things and you think, I'm doing this because I really believe it's better for my children. My mother grew up in a different time. And it's not just because she was from Iran. At the time that she grew up in America, it was the same thing. We had the same Twiggy. We had the same pressures to be thin. And women's values were in a different space back then, even though we have, like, kind of things come back around too, mm-hmm. right? Now with GLP-1s and the way celebrities have become ultra thin. So
It's never static, right?
It's never static, right? It goes back and forth. But so it was a process over time. And the one thing, and I talk about this on a couple of the pieces I've written and I incorporated into the book, is to heal, you need the people that have the conflict to be honest about what they've done and take accountability for that. So my mother and I's relationship would have never healed if she hadn't said, I'm sorry. I know what I did wasn't the right thing to do, and I know it hurt you. That sentence alone can go a long way to, like, you know, makes you less guarded. And my fight started to diminish. And when I became a mother, it diminished again. Like, I not only, like, understand it, like, you have empathy for that person. And then you can talk honestly about it.
Is there a way for parents, because, you know, talk about, like, body image or these unrealistic body images, right? And they're so damaging. But then, like, on the end of that, like, there's, like obesity that causes health problems.
Yes.
So if you're a parent and you have a child who does have, the emotional eating and is having some problems, is there a way to approach that without destroying the kid's trust or belief in themselves?
I believe there is. And I know it's complicated because mothers have written to me after some of the articles I've written, like, what do I do? I think there's a way to talk about it without saying that you're not right the way you are to your child. You know, we didn't have really, like, my mother and I didn't go exercise together. We didn't go on walks together. We didn't have activities together. You'd show by example, there's a lot of ways. I'm not a therapist, and I think that is important. I wish I had had a therapist when I was young to help me through that. Part of it is health, and that's important. We want our kids to be healthy. Part of it is genetics. Mm-hmm. There is a genetic element, and it's
probably more than half, right?
Right. I've interviewed experts on this, doctors, and, you know, professors, all, and there is a balance between what we can do with our bodies to be healthier and kind of the shape of our body genetically. And it's two different things, but I completely understand, and we want our kids to be healthy. So I would say to a mother, seek outside guidance on that. And sometimes it's better coming from another person, a doctor, a therapist that can talk to your child. And you as the mother can say, I love you unconditionally. I just love you. That's it. And then have, like, maybe a third person that can help with getting the health elements together.
That makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah. Bringing someone in so you don't damage that maternal relationship.
Yes.
But they can address what could be an
issue. Absolutely.
Is there a way, because like, you know, we all do the emotional eating, right? And it's like when you have stressors and you have the cortisone levels are going up. And so when you eat, and especially with sugar, it creates this dopamine hit and it makes you feel better. Mm-hmm. In talking to all these experts over these years, have you found a way to, like, redirect that behavior? You know, like a different way to break that habit? Because it's physiological, right? So it's a real addiction, right?
It's true.
Sugar's like cocaine.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there are different tools that I think it's best coming from, like, either an eating disorder specialist or a therapist in terms of behavior. For me, I struggled with bulimia for many years. So 30 years, I would say, even maybe a little bit more. So I had to change my mindset on that. And that comes from letting the desperation leave, letting the shame leave, letting the secrets leave. Once some of that stuff is gone, you don't have that urge, like for really eating disorder elements of urge of like, you know, secret eating or binging or some of those more dangerous things.
Purging.
Habits. Right, purging. So once those elements go, then it's, you know, what they say, which is a struggle for me still, but it's mindful eating. Like you want to enjoy your food. You don't want to use it as a tool to try to make yourself feel better.
Right. So how big a problem is this, like in this country? Like how big is this? Is this a point of conflict between like most mother daughters?
That's a good question. I don't, you know, I think that when we teenagers, by just women, girls and boys, are trying to find a way to be individuals. And I'm not an expert at this at all, but I have two boys and I was, in my own experience as a teenager. And so when you get to that age, it's such a sensitive age. You want to be your own person. You still want to be loved by your parents, but you want them not to tell you constantly to be something or control you. So it's a real balance. From what I've read and seen, it's like, as long as they know that you're there and that you love them and that you are there to listen to them and you're guiding them as best as you can. But once they get to a certain age, 15, 16, 17, some of that is, and I wasn't great at this either, stepping back a little bit and being like, instead of constantly trying to fix everything you're trying to tell me, it's like listening and for them to feel comfortable coming to you. So that communication is everything. You don't want your kids to start keeping secrets from you because they're afraid you're going to criticize them. Because hearing those problems is so critical to be able to be that, you know, a lot of mental health issues for kids. You want to keep those lines open without kind of too much judgment and criticism.
So when you're writing for children and you're talking about like problems with parenting, essentially, right? In the way they're doing damage, probably unintentionally, but they're doing damage. How do you balance when the messaging to children, because you're basically criticizing a lot of their parents at the same time. Were you aware of like when you're doing this, like how I have to do this in a certain way? Because they're complicated relationships, right? And a lot of the damage is unintentional.
Yeah. You know, I'll go back to like what I had to do for the book. I had to make sure that the mother is not the bad guy and the child is the good guy, because both the teenager in the book, which I wrote it from my perspective, makes mistakes and the mother makes mistakes, but we have to see kind of why they're both doing that. They both have a yearning to be seen, to belong, to be, to find love between each other. And in this book, and I think in real life, sometimes we need a third party. So in this book, she has a best friend who is concerned about her. There's teachers and counselors that help. There's a father that kind of steps in when they see that something is wrong. And in real life, I think kids, and I've said this before, it doesn't have to be a parent that hears your secret. As long as it's somebody that you trust, maybe it's a therapist, maybe it's a teacher, maybe it's a counselor. But the important thing is to like be able to talk about it outside of yourself, in your mind. Keeping secrets is dangerous. Keeping shame inside is dangerous, because we make it so much worse in our minds than it potentially is. So when I'm talking to kids at schools, say, you know, tell somebody you trust. It could be just your best friend, but talking about it really helps. That's kind of what I think helped me too, even though I was much older than 13. But once I said it out loud for the first time of my own secret that I kept, it really released a lot and helped me become healthier.
That's a great message. When you're writing this from a child's point of view, did you have trouble going back into that voice?
Not at all. Not even a little bit. It's funny because my son at the time, I was saying I'm writing a 13-year-old, and he said, you know, that sounds right. You're like a 13-year-old.
I love it.
And then I've said this in interviews with friends of mine, girlfriends of mine. They're like, yeah, you're kind of like that, because hanging out with you, like I had a friend who stayed with me for a week. She's like, being in your house is like being at a slumber party. I like to be goofy, and I like to, you know, I have still that kind of wonder and joy of a, and I write about this. I have also the other things. I'm going through a midlife thing, like a 50s perimenopause, menopause. I'll tell you something. A lot of those things are very similar to teenagers. We are going through a lot of emotional things. We get pimples all of a sudden. We have all those heightened emotions. So yeah, no, it felt very, very fun. Natural for me.
That's great. So we're getting ready to wrap up. We have so many writers who watch this thing. Yeah. So like, what did you write in? Do you write in Word? Do you write in Scrivener? Do you write with a pen and paper?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did write in Word. I tried Google Docs. It doesn't work for me. I tried Scrivener, and that did help, because sometimes you're writing a scene and you're not sure where to put it. And Scrivener let me kind of put different sections in just to like have it there. And I've said this before. I went to a conference early on, one writing conference, the Barrel House. It's a DC conference. And I heard somebody say they've written their entire memoir through their notes app.
Yeah.
And that freed me.
Yeah.
And this is so early. I don't think I'd written even 5 pages of this book yet. Because I thought, if you're writing a book, all those people, they must have some magic. Or like, you have to be in a room alone for like 30 hours at a time to write a book. And that's not true. I wrote so much of this book on my notes app. Because a scene comes to you while you're walking or something. And I dictate the scenes into my notes app.
I love to hear that. Yes. Right? I do that too. Yeah.
And then I download the... You know, it's all messy and weird and stuff. And what I would do is put each scene, I would just do it in my notes app, put it into different sections in Scrivener. And then later on, I really used Word to put the actual document together.
So you can take Scrivener and you can actually compile it as Word too, right?
Yeah.
So I do almost the exact same thing. So that's really,
I love that.
That's really fun. Do you listen to music when you're doing it? You said you kind of do it everywhere when you're walking.
Yeah.
Did you ever have like a set time? Like you're like, I'm going to work right for 2 hours today.
So I have, what I did for this book, because I did it in a year. So I really wrote 2-3 hours a day, when I was in the depths of it. And honestly, I can't write for more than 3 hours.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. And no, I don't have any music. It has to be completely silent. And I have to like really not be distracted. I have there's a free co-writing group that's run by Allison K. Williams. I love her. She's been a great mentor to me. And it's online. It's a Zoom. You can get on, not get on. And it's very specific times from 12:30 to 2. I use that. I got on that throughout the year. Every weekday, and then I would write about 2-3 hours a day.
And do you do anything specific to like access your creativity when you're sitting down to write? Is there anything, are there rituals or a mindset, or how do you get started when you first sit down and start writing?
You know what? The hardest part is opening that document and shutting off everything else. And I have a hard time with that because I am completely addicted to my phone. Social media and YouTube and all the things everybody else is addicted to. So shutting that off is really my biggest challenge. Once I'm in the document and I start into it, then I'm hooked. And somebody told me this, that's so true. If you don't love doing the writing of your story, it's not even worth it. It's not going to come out to be the thing that you want. You have to really enjoy what you're writing. I enjoyed writing this, and I felt excited about it a lot. Frustrated, it was difficult, draft after draft. I read a lot of my work out loud. That's the way I edit. Either I read it out loud or I have the computer read it. I bought a program called Speech, I think it's called.
Speechify,
yeah. And yes, it's great. And I read everything, or she reads it out loud for me, and I edit, edit, edit. I read it again and again and again.
And did you learn this through, like, you said you went and took writing classes or talking to other people? Because you're doing a lot of the things that make you very productive and efficient. Did you learn it from other people, or did you just figure it out yourself?
No, I learned it from other people. I can't remember who said it first, but I've told this story before, and I love this story. David Sedaris is one of my favorite writers, and really one of the reasons I want to become a writer.
He's so funny.
Yeah. I remember reading his first book many, many years ago, and I thought it was magic. It was magic. How is he writing something I connect with so deeply that can make me cry and laugh in the same essay? How? It's amazing. It's just like, honestly, I thought it was magic. And for years, I was like, that would be the dream. The dream, the dream, the dream. My biggest, biggest dream. So years go by, I start writing, and I go to see him at the Kennedy Center. And I'm sitting with my husband, and he says, oh, does anyone have a question? And I put my hand up, and the person right in front of me, in this huge Kennedy Center, puts his hand up. Me and this guy right in front of me. And he picks the guy in front of me. And I was devastated. I wanted to ask him a question so bad. And then he went to other people, and I thought to myself, he's not going to pick the same exact place. And he said, well, any other last questions? And my husband said, ask your question, do it. And so I put my hand up, and he picked me. I stood up and I said, you know, and this is true. A lot of my friends say, and a lot of writing experts say, you need other, like a group. You need a writing group. You need a writing partner. You need somebody else to read your writing. Because when you miss some things by just writing, you know. And I just can't be that person. I'm not that person. I need to be by myself. And I need to just do it myself. I don't know why. And even though, of course, like I have friends that have read my stuff. And I said, what do you think? Do you have other people that read your stuff over the years? And he said, never. I do it all myself. But what I do is read it out loud. Yeah. Again and again and again. That's how I started writing, he said. I think if you know his story, he started actually reading his essays before, you know. And I thought, oh, yes, that's what I've heard. That feels right to me. And then I became religious about it. Everything I write, I read it out loud like a ton of times, because your ears will tell you when a sentence doesn't work.
Yeah, you hear the music of the language, right? Yeah. I do the same thing, by the way. And I know a lot of writers who do that. Nobody sees any of it till it's finished. And then you can go get the other opinions.
Yeah.
Well, this is a really important message, and your writing's great, and your storytelling is great, right? Both those components of that.
Thank you.
Where should people go to buy this book?
This book is sold anywhere books are sold, but you can get it on my website. I have links to a couple of different places. It's RebeccaKMorrison.com.
Well, congratulations. I know this is going to be really successful.
Thank you so much.
So nice to meet you. Thank you very much.